You are listening to The Point from MC3 in Lewistown, Pennsylvania. Check us out on the web at mc3church.org or find us on Facebook at mc3church. MC3, it's like nothing you'd expect.
So it's been about, probably 7 or 8 years since I've had a recliner. There's nothing more relaxing to me than getting in my recliner, kicking my feet up, having a little drink, maybe a little snack beside me, and I got a lot of feedback. I'm not sure what's going on here. You know, and having my remote, and sitting down on, say, like a Saturday afternoon, Sunday afternoon, and watching a little football. Love it. Love my recliner. Get a little tired, lean back, take a little cat nap. Don't get much better than this. See, my wife wasn't a big fan so much of the recliner because back when we first got married, I'd settle in and she'd come over and she'd want to snuggle and I'd be like, but I'm not very comfortable. And so we haven't had the recliner for a while. But the point is, I'm a big fan of being comfortable. There's ways that I tend to like things. And let me get the right one here. So as a matter of fact, just as a reminder to this morning, I brought myself this nice little carpet. For those of you that know my reputation, I will make very good use of this carpet this morning. I tend to pace a lot, so I brought this so I could be comfortable as I pace. See, I want you to actually think of a time this morning to where maybe life wasn't so comfortable. Maybe it was just downright hard. You know, maybe this is a time where finances were really, really tight. I remember there was 1 year, it seemed like everything that could happen happened with Hannah and I. Just like one thing after the next. We're not talking like somebody, you know, broke our cup that cost 50 cents. I mean, like it was one thing after the next, hundreds of dollars, nearly $1,000 for some of the things that came along. And it just, every month seemed like there were a couple of things that hit us, and it was just, that was a rough year. And that's the first thing that came to my head. But maybe for you, you're thinking of a time where you lost somebody that you loved dearly. Maybe it would be a time where, you know, again, maybe finances were tight. Maybe it was something that was done to you. Maybe you've been abused in the past in some way or another. Maybe you have struggled with not being able to have children. Maybe there's something at a job that happened where you lost your job. But I want you to kind of think right now, maybe a time where you've really struggled, where things were not comfortable at all for you, and they were just plain hard. Maybe it's something you're going through now. Maybe it's something you've gone through in the past. But I want you to think about that thing and just kind of keep it in the back of your mind as we go this morning. See, this morning, we're going to talk about Joseph. And the point this morning is providing by a life of purpose. Genesis 50, 20 and 21 says, "Though you meant to harm me, God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, for the saving of many lives." And as we look at Joseph this morning, the first thing, let me say this before I get going here. This is a story of God's love, of restoration, of salvation, of sovereignty, of integrity. There's so many things about this story, and I'll tell you, there's so much written about Joseph, and I have 1 hour to try and communicate to you what I want to get across this morning. And so there's going to be stuff I'm going to fly by. You're going to think, man, I could have spent more time on that. For those of you that have been around church for a long time, you're going to be like, man, he kind of flew by that. But that's okay. And I know Brian mentioned last week, and I'll reiterate what he said last week. There's going to be some really cool stories I'm just going to kind of point out as we go, and I'm not going to be able to spend time on them. Man, get in the Bible and check them out. There's going to be some really awesome stories that I can't spend time on this morning. You can get more of the story. Get into it on your own. Read and discover it for yourself. But ultimately, this is a story of all these things that I mentioned already, but it's ultimately a story of God looking out and providing for his young nation, Israel. So let's start off this morning by determining which man it is that we're talking about. See, if I say Moses, you probably know who I'm talking about, even if you haven't been in church for very long. If I say Moses, a lot of people probably kind of know of him or maybe a little something about him. Or Noah, you know, they even did a kind of a play on that story recently with the movie with Steve Carell in it. I believe it was Evan Almighty. You know, so there people, even if you haven't been in church for a while, you probably have heard of some of these guys, you know, Noah, Moses. You know, for those of you that have been in church for a long time, you probably know these stories very well. You know, Abraham, you probably know who I'm talking about. But if I say Joseph, I know back when I was a young believer, young follower of Christ, I tended to get confused as to who they were talking about. Because when you said Joseph, I automatically thought of the husband of Mary, the earthly father of Jesus, right? But that's not who we're talking about this morning. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about who it is that we're talking about. Abraham, I mentioned a minute ago. Abraham was actually his great-grandfather. Abraham was promised by God that God would make him a great nation. He said that his offspring would be like the sand of the seashore, like the stars of the sky, that you wouldn't even be able to count them. Well, the thing is, Abraham and Sarah for the longest time couldn't even have kids. They kind of tried to do it their own way, and eventually God does give Abraham and Isaac a son. And that's in chapter 21 of Genesis, and their son was named Isaac. Now, Isaac is Joseph's grandfather. So there's a pretty cool story, actually, in Genesis chapter 22, right after they finally, God gives them their son Isaac. Abraham's tested. God says, take him up on this mountain and worship me, and basically, I want you to sacrifice him to me. And so this son that they waited so long for, God puts Abraham to the test. Well, if you know the story, you're familiar with the story, basically, right as he's about to do what he's supposed to do, God stops him and provides a lamb for the sacrifice, and Abraham passed God's test with flying colors. And so as we move on in chapter 24 then, Isaac, there's this really cool story where Abraham's about to die, and he says to his servant, I want you to go find me a wife for my son in the land of my fathers. I want it to be from our family. I don't want it to be one of these foreign women. So there's this really cool story, again, read it for yourself, where Abraham's servant goes, and all these things work out just right for him to find Rebecca for Isaac. So Isaac and Rebecca then get married, and as we move on, they end up having some sons, a couple of twins, actually, twin boys, Jacob and Esau. But interestingly, Rebecca, much like Sarah, was also for the longest time was not able to have children. So anyways, they have these twins, Jacob and Esau, and Jacob was actually the younger of the two brothers. And, you know, as it was back in the day, generally the older son would get the birthright and the blessing and all the stuff, but Jacob ended up deceiving his father a few times and gets both of those, both the blessing and the birthright. And so, interesting story there. As we move on to chapter 29 of Genesis, Jacob now is going and he wants to find himself a wife, and he finds this young lady named Rachel who he loved. And he wants to marry Rachel. And so he goes to her father Laban and says, I'd like to marry your daughter. And they come to this agreement. He says, I will work 7 years to marry your daughter. And Laban's like, all right, that sounds like a good deal. I'll go for that. You work for me 7 years, I'll give you my daughter. So he does it. He works 7 years. And apparently weddings were a little different back in the day than they are now. See, apparently they didn't take all kind of time to go find the perfect dress and to get just the right invitations and send them out ahead of time and make sure they had the right wedding coordinator and the perfect place and, you know, just the right flowers and, you know, all this stuff. Because, see, after these 7 years are up, it says that Jacob went into the tent and married his wife. I'll keep it PG because I didn't give you a PG-13 warning before we started this morning. And he marries his wife. And, excuse me. But he wakes up in the morning and, you know, I don't know how this happens. I don't know how he just doesn't realize this until he wakes up in the morning. Maybe he had a little too much wine that night because he was pretty excited. I'm not sure. But he wakes up and finds out that it's not Rachel that he married. It was Leah, her older sister. And he's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. He goes to Laban and says, listen, I was supposed to marry Rachel. And you deceived me. Interestingly, Jacob, the one who deceived, has been known to be a little deceiving himself in the past, has been deceived. And he ends up marrying Leah. Well, long story short, they come to an agreement, and Laban's like, all right, you work for me 7 more years, I'll give you Rachel. Now, just so you know, he didn't have to wait 7 more years. Actually, he had to wait a week, and then he was able to marry Rachel. And, well, they did get married, but you know what I mean. Anyways, and then he works his 7 years, okay? So, basically, he did end up working 14 years for Rachel, but he worked 7, got married to Leah a week later, married Rachel, and worked 7 more years as part of the agreement. So, moving on. So Jacob, of course, is Joseph's father. Now, there's an interesting chapter, again, I'm not going to get into the details, in chapter 32, where Jacob wrestles with God. He doesn't realize this man attacks him in the middle of the night. We find out that he actually was wrestling with God. And I just mentioned this chapter because it's interesting. You know, it shows that God is willing to fight for his people. And we're going to see as we look into our story this morning that this is actually one of the first times that God does. He does what he needs to do to take care of his people, of his young nation. So that's in chapter 32. Then moving on to chapter 35 of Genesis, Rachel, much like her mother-in-law and her grandmother-in-law, was not able to have children for the longest time. Actually, Leah, the wife that Joseph had at first, had no problem. She was basically a little baby factory, just popping out sons left and right. And then finally, after a period of time, Rachel gives birth to a son, and his name was Joseph. And at that point, that was in chapter 30. I failed to mention chapter 30. Then in chapter 35, Rachel actually has another son, and that son was Benjamin. So at that point, when she gave birth to Benjamin, Rachel died. So we talked about which man we're talking about, the great-grandson of Abraham, grandson of Isaac, son of Jacob. So he's got quite the family line. There's a lot of pretty awesome history there. So that's the Joseph we're talking about this morning. So now we're going to talk about becoming a man. In James chapter 1, verses 2 and 3, it says, "Consider it pure joy, my brothers and sisters, whenever you face trials of many kinds, because you know that the testing of your faith produces perseverance." See, I asked you guys to think of something tough that you've gone through in your life. Maybe it's something you're dealing with right now. Maybe it's something you dealt with in the past. But God allows us to go through things for a reason. Sean actually did a series a while back where he talked about the different reasons that God allows things to happen to us. And one of those things is because sometimes it's to grow us and to strengthen us and to develop us as his servant. And so, kind of like it says here in James, when you go through these things, it teaches you, it grows you. It, in this case, your faith produces perseverance. So we're going to look at a little bit of a story of a struggle this morning as we look at the life of Joseph and some of the things that he had to deal with and God brought him through. So we're going to look at the ups and downs as we talk about him becoming a man. We're going to look at the ups and downs, and then later on we're going to talk about some dreams that Joseph had dealt with later on in his life. And so, first of all, the ups and downs. We're going to be in Genesis chapter 37 this morning. Basically, the last 13 or so chapters of Genesis are about Joseph. I'm going to focus on about 7 or 8 of them. I'm going to just let you know I'm going to be talking fast. I'm not going to have all of the verses. Actually, I'm not going to have really any of the verses in Genesis up there. So I just, if you want to follow along, do the best you can. We're going to be starting at chapter 37. I'll try to let you know where I'm at if you want to kind of skim along or read along as I'm talking this morning. But we're going to be moving fast. So starting in chapter 37, at this point, Joseph is on top of the world. In the first few verses, we find out that Joseph brings back a report of his brothers, a bad report. And it goes on to say that his brothers actually weren't very fond of him. See, Jacob actually made him this fancy coat. And it was very obvious to the brothers that Joseph was the favorite. And they didn't like that a whole lot. And to make it worse, he's 17 years old at this point. And those of you, if you know what a 17-year-old boy is like, or maybe when you were a 17-year-old boy, we'll actually learn later on, we'll read later on, that it says Joseph was a handsome and well-built man. So I'm sure at this point he's a good-looking young guy. He's his father's favorite. He's the one that goes out and kind of spies on his brother and brings back his brother, "Hey, Dad, they're up to no good." I'm sure Joseph is pretty confident in himself. You know, we don't find a whole lot wrong with Joseph, but the one thing maybe we can say is at this point he might have been a little bit immature. He could have been a little bit, maybe a little arrogant, because he kind of had everything going his way. He was on top of the world at this point, and everything was just the way, you'd want it to be, I guess, at that age. And Joseph, it says in verse 5, had this dream. So here comes this confident 17-year-old brother that his brothers just don't like him, and he comes out and he says, "Listen," he said, "I had this dream." Okay, he says, "And we're binding sheaves, and mine stood upright, and your sheaves, they gathered around mine and they bowed down to it." Isn't that cool? And they're like, "What are you saying? You actually intend to reign over us? Are you going to rule us?" So they hated him all the more for what he said. Then it says he had another dream. I don't know if it's a little bit later, maybe the next day, whatever. He has this other dream. He comes out and he says, "Guys, listen. He said, "I had this other dream, and the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowed down to me." And so when his father heard this, he's Jacob's favorite. I understand. But even at this point, Jacob's like, "Okay, Joseph, that's enough. Do you actually think that your mother and I and your brothers are going to come and bow down to the ground before you?" He says his brothers were jealous of him. We're down in verse 11 at this point. But his father kept the matter in mind. So as he starts out, he's on top of the world. But things tend to change real quickly for Joseph. See, a little bit later, moving on to verses 12, 13, it says his father was sending him out yet again to check on his brothers. They're supposed to be up in the area of Shechem, grazing their flocks. And just a little backstory here. There's actually good reason that Jacob sends him out to check on them in this particular situation. See, if you go back to chapter 34, here's another really cool story. Jacob and Leah actually had a daughter named Dinah. And Dinah was out with the local ladies hanging out, and at one point in the area of Shechem, and Shechem, the person named Shechem, actually raped her. And the brothers weren't very happy when they found this out. They actually went storming over to the area of Shechem. They were intending to do some damage. And Hamar, Shechem's father, comes out and tries to reason with the brothers and says, "Hey, how about this? My son loves your daughter." You know, almost like, "Well, it's okay. He loves her." Well, no, he's starting to reason with me. He's like, "My son loves your daughter. How about you let her marry him, and you can come and settle in our land. We'll make this deal. You can come settle in our land and enjoy our possessions. You can marry our daughters. We'll marry your daughters. And, you know, how about that? We'll kind of make this deal." And the brothers are like, you know, Hamar's up to something here. Obviously, he's trying to get his son off the hook, and he's got other ulterior motives as well, as we'll see in a second. But the brothers are like, "Okay, we'll do this. But this is the thing." See, now the brothers are up to something too. They said, "It's detestable for us for our women to marry your men because they're uncircumcised. So if you get circumcised, we will agree to this, and we'll come in and we'll settle with you, and we'll let our daughters marry your men, and vice versa." And so Hamar goes and tells his men. He says, "Listen, if we do this, if we have this done, they'll come in, they'll settle with us, and they'll bring all of their possessions. And won't their things essentially become our things?" So he's thinking, "Yeah, this is good all around for us." So he convinces his men. They're like, "Okay." Now, I don't know about you. I think a lot of men in here probably were circumcised. It tends to be an American tradition for the most part. Apparently, well, I saw on the news the other day. Apparently, that's changing. But I don't remember it being that painful, because I don't remember when I was like two. So I don't think it was that bad. But I've heard that if you do it when you're older, it can be quite painful. I've actually heard a story. I know of one person that had it done when they were older, and it is quite painful. And again, I'm not going to get into the details of what that is if you don't know what it is. Again, we're going to keep it PG-13 or PG this morning. So if you don't know, kids, ask your mom and dad. That'll be fun. But anyways, so they decide to have this done. And it says 3 days later, they were in a lot of pain. And it says while they were still in pain, Simeon and Levi went in with the swords and basically just killed all the men. Took all their stuff, took their possessions, took their money, took their wives and daughters. The brothers were up to something too. They just kind of took Hamar's little scheme and turned it back around on them. And so obviously Jacob wasn't real pleased with this. But anyways, back to where we're at in our story now in chapter 37. See, Jacob has a little reason to be concerned at this point. So Joseph goes up, and his brothers aren't there. Finds out that they've moved on about 15 or so miles down the road to this area of Dothan. And when they see him coming, of course, he's got his fancy coat on, and he's walking, you know, towards them to find out what's going on. And they start amongst each other. Remember, we've mentioned three times at this point already. Well, it's been mentioned. I haven't mentioned it, but it's been actually written three times at this point that they hated their brother. They couldn't even speak a kind word to him. They start scheming, saying, let's kill him. Let's just be rid of this guy. He's, you know, that way we don't have to keep putting up with his little cockiness and, you know, deal with him being dad's favorite. You know, let's just get rid of this guy. So Reuben's like, "Listen, let's not kill him. He's our brother." So as he gets there, they strip him of his coat, and they throw him in this pit or this well, whatever you want to call it. And they leave him there, and they proceed to eat. And while they're eating, at some point Reuben gets up and walks away, and there's this group of traders that come by, these Midianites. And Judah, who you'll find out is the one that oftentimes tends to be the one that does the talking. He tends to like to manipulate the situations. And in this case, he decided that they could manipulate this situation in a way that would benefit them. And he says to his brothers, "What do you say we sell him? Let's sell him to these traders. So we'll make a little coin, be rid of him. Let's see what becomes of his dreams at that point." So they sell him off to these Midianites. And so a little bit later on, they then trade him or sell him to the house of Potiphar. So we're moving on now to so he started out that Joseph was on top of the world. Then at this point, he was down in the pit. And from here, things just get a little bit worse. So moving on to chapter 38, we're going to go a lot lower at this point. So chapter 38, if you're reading through Genesis, you might wonder, why is this here? Because from 38 through 50, more or less, is about Joseph and his family. Now, obviously, Judah is part of the family, but this one chapter just simply focuses on him, and I'm going to try and be real quick here. But I think one of the things is this chapter is kind of there to contrast the life of Judah to the life of Joseph. See, Judah, as we already know, was kind of manipulating things here, trying to make a little money off of the sale of his brother. And it says right after this, he actually moved on to the area of Canaan and got himself a wife, which the interesting thing here is just a few chapters ago, his brothers went in and basically killed all of the men in Shechem because this was a detestable thing, right? So they kill all these women, kill all these men and stuff for what they did to his sister. But here he is now doing this thing that is not acceptable for the Hebrews at this time to intermarry with this Canaanite woman. So he does this, and it says that he has three sons, Onan, and Shelah. Hopefully I'm pronouncing them right. If not, I apologize. But Onan, and Shelah, and it says in verse 6 that Judah found a wife. And in verse 7, it just goes on to say that was so wicked in the eyes of the Lord that God killed him. So he marries, and not long after, he dies. Well, apparently the custom of the day was, this Levirate custom or whatever it was, that if somebody dies without having any children and there's a younger brother that could do so, it was their duty to then marry this person to preserve the line. And to me, that's weird. I would think if Onan went and did his thing with Tamar and they had kids, I would think they would be Onan's kids. But apparently the way it was that, you know, that's how it worked. That was considered to be Ur's line. So he's supposed to do this thing, and he goes and does what he's supposed to do. But apparently in such a way that he's not able to give her children. So those of you that understand what I'm talking about, he didn't allow her to get pregnant while doing his marital duties. Okay? So, and if you can read in there, you can see the details if you want. We're in chapter 38 at this point, somewhere around verse 8, I believe. And it says that God found that was wicked in God's sight as well, so he ends up killing Onan. So now we're down to, Judah just has one son left, Shelah. Well, and he says, he's too young, I can't give him to you at this point. And he says, Tamar, go back and live with your family. And here a few verses later, Judah's wife dies, and at one point, Judah's on his way to this town called Timnah, which must be the area where Tamar and her family are at, because Tamar finds out that he's coming. And she decides to take off her widow's clothes and put this veil on. You know, back in the dam, if you've ever seen some of the women over in that area, this is probably a veil that you probably can't see much of her face. It was enough anyways that Judah couldn't recognize her. And so she goes out around the temple and poses as a prostitute. And so Judah stops by and decides to purchase her services. And so Judah does this thing, but he doesn't have anything to pay with. And so he promises her a goat. And she says, but what can you leave me to guarantee your payment? So he leaves this sealing cord and a staff. And here, moving ahead, a few months later, it says that Tamar was found to be pregnant. And once Judah finds out about this, now he's acting all righteous. Oh, you were supposed to wait for my youngest son. And he says, bring her out and burn her. But she sends this message out to Judah and says, well, I'm pregnant by the person who owns this seal and cord and staff. Do you recognize them? And Judah's like, oh, crap. Says, yeah, you're a little bit more righteous than I am. And so, really, this chapter kind of gives us a glimpse into the life of Judah and how evil, really, and how sinful he was at this point. Whereas as we get into the story of Joseph, we'll see that Joseph is not that at all. And so it's kind of there to contrast, and we'll see a little bit later. It's interesting how things kind of change as well. So moving on, at first, Joseph's down in the pit, he's on top of the world, and he's down in the pit, sold off by his brothers, completely rejected. Could you imagine? Could you imagine if you had siblings that were willing to come to the point that they would kill you or just sell you off like a dog? I mean, so this is not an easy thing that Joseph's dealing with. I told you guys to try to think about something, a tough time you're going through or have been going through. And at this point, Joseph, he's got to feel lonely. It's got to be really hard to just completely be rejected by your family like that. So Joseph is going through a tough, very tough time at this point. But look what happens as we move on to chapter 39. He actually ascends in Potiphar's house. Starting in verse 2, it says, "The Lord was with Joseph so that he prospered, and he lived in the house of his Egyptian master. When his master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord gave him success in everything he did, Joseph found favor in his eyes and became his attendant. Potiphar put him in charge of his household, and he entrusted to his care everything that he owned. From the time he put him in charge of his household and all that he owned, the Lord blessed the household of the Egyptian master because of Joseph. The blessing of the Lord was on everything that Potiphar had, both in the house and in the field. So Potiphar left everything he had to Joseph's care. With Joseph in charge, he did not concern himself with anything but the food he ate." So God was with Joseph. It says at this point, he blessed everything he did. What a great song to end with. Never once. Never once did Joseph walk alone. Never once did he do it on his own. God was with him the whole time, and he brought him through it. And in this case, he's lifting him up. Now he ascends in Potiphar's house. But the thing is, this doesn't apparently last real long, because if you move on, if you've looked ahead already, you're going to see in verse 7, things change. Well, actually, the end of verse 6, it says, this is what I mentioned earlier, "Joseph was well-built and handsome. And after his master's wife, Potiphar's wife, took notice of Joseph and said, 'Come to bed with me.' But he refused. 'With me in charge,' he told her, 'my master does not concern himself with anything.'" He goes on to say a verse or so later, says, "How then could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" She spoke to Joseph day after day and said, "Come to bed with me." She pursued him and pursued him and pursued him. And every time he did the right thing. He refused her advances until this one particular day. Joseph kind of got cornered. It said in verse 11 that there was this particular time where it was just him and Potiphar's wife. There was nobody else around. And I have a feeling, from what I know of Joseph at this point, he probably didn't let himself get in that situation too often. Maybe he was in the room. Maybe she sees the situation and takes advantage of it. And she comes in and she grabs his clothing and says, again, "Come to bed with me." And so he does what every strong, tough man should do at this point. He turned tail and he ran out of there, leaving his coat behind. Because he was going to do whatever it took to do the right thing. And he hightailed it out of there. Well, so Potiphar's wife tries to take this situation and turn it around on Joseph. And so she goes to Potiphar and says, look, I have his coat. Joseph tried to make sport of me. Basically, she accused him of trying to do what she's been doing the whole time. And so at this point, things take a turn for the worse again for Joseph. So this is twice now. We're going to see that Joseph has done nothing wrong, but he had to suffer because of it, you know, even so. And, you know, a lot of times I think we look at our situations in life and think, this isn't fair. This isn't right. I'm going to get them back for this. And we have this victim mentality, and we make it all about us. And Joseph twice has to suffer and deal with these situations. But if we see, as we see the life of Joseph, as we continue to go on, Joseph just trusted God wherever he was at. He did the best with what he had and with the situation that he was in. It actually says in 1 Peter 3:17 and 18. 1 Peter 3:17 and 18, it says, "For it is better, if it is God's will, to suffer for doing good than for doing evil. For Christ also suffered once for sins, the righteous for the unrighteous, to bring you to God. He was put to death in the body, but made alive in the spirit." But this idea that, you know, it's better to suffer for doing God's will, for doing right. And I believe Joseph totally understood that. He's like, "God, I don't understand this. I don't know why you've put me through this, you know, in a couple of situations now, but I'm going to do the best I can in the situation that you put me in, and I'm going to trust you to help me through it." So at this point, Potiphar, upon hearing what his wife said, decides to throw Joseph in prison. Now, I'm sure back in the day, a man of his stature probably could have done more than that, but if you remember back in the first few verses of the chapter there in chapter 39, that he saw that God was with him, that God blessed everything that Joseph did. And I think this was hard for Potiphar to swallow. I think he probably really cared for Joseph. And so he did what he had to do, and he just threw him into prison rather than doing anything worse at this point. But so he throws him into prison. But this is the interesting. If you go down to the end of the chapter in verses 20 through 21, it says, the second part of verse 20 says, "But while Joseph was there in prison, the Lord was with him, and he showed him kindness and granted him favor in the eyes of the prison warden. So the warden put Joseph in charge of all those held in prison, and he was made responsible for all that was done there." The warden paid no attention to anything under Joseph's care, because the Lord was with Joseph and gave him success in everything that he did. So this is the second time now where we see that Joseph, put into a terrible situation, just simply does the best he can with a tough situation. And God was with him. God made it to where people couldn't help but notice how good of a man Joseph was. And God ends up putting him in a spot where he was essentially in charge of prisoners. It says while he was there, so he was started out on top of the world. He was thrown down in the pit then, and then we looked at the life of Judah, and things got a little bit lower there even. And then we see that he ascends in Potiphar's household. But then things happen with Potiphar's wife, and he descends down into prison. And then here we are, he actually rises back up into a good position here while he's in prison. The warden notices him and puts him in charge. And while he's there and he's in charge of these prisoners, it says that there were two officials of Pharaoh's court, a baker and a cupbearer, and they did something that offended Pharaoh. So Pharaoh decides to throw them into prison. And it ends up that they actually were put under Joseph's care. So we move on now. We're in chapter 40 at this point. And we move down to verse 6, I believe, is where we're starting. And I'll tell you in a second once my iPad works. Okay. So verse 6, it says, when Joseph came the next morning, he saw that they were dejected. So he asked his officials who were in custody with him in the master's house, why do you look so sad today? And basically they said, well, we both had these dreams. And we can't understand them. Nobody can, we can't make sense of them. So Joseph said, well, do not interpret interpretations belong to God. Tell me your dreams. So down in verse 9, we hear of the cupbearer's dream. It says, in my dream, I saw a vine in front of me, and on the vine were three branches. As soon as it budded, it blossomed, and its clusters ripened into grapes. Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes and squeezed them into Pharaoh's cups, and I put the cup in his hand. Well, Joseph said, this is what your dream means. The three branches are 3 days. And in 3 days, you're actually going to be restored to your position in Pharaoh's household. You're going to once again start put the cup in his hand. And so after hearing this favorable report of his dream, the baker then at this point says, okay, well, here's my dream. He says, I had this dream where there were three baskets on my head. And in the top of the basket were all kind of baked goods for Pharaoh, but the birds were eating them out of the basket of my on my head. And Joseph said, well, here's what your dream means. He says, in 3 days, Pharaoh is going to cut off your head and impale you on a stake. And so, needless to say, see, after telling the cupbearer's dream, Joseph says, remember me when you're before Pharaoh. Well, there's no comment after the baker's dream. I have a feeling the baker's reaction probably wasn't as good. But anyway, so some time passes. And so some time passed, actually a couple years passed. And the cupbearer never did remember Joseph. And it goes on to say that everything actually happened just as Joseph had said. It says a few days later, it was Pharaoh's birthday, and the cupbearer and the baker were both brought up. And just as Joseph said, the cupbearer was restored to his position. The baker had gone and on a stake. And so this time passed, a couple years passed, and he never did remember Joseph. But then we move on now to Pharaoh's dreams. And the first 8 verses, basically Pharaoh shares his dreams and looks for people to interpret it. He couldn't find anybody. And then at this point in verse 9, the cupbearer realizes his shortcomings. He's like, oh, yeah, I forgot about this guy. So he goes on to tell Pharaoh about how Joseph, when he and the baker were in prison, they had dreams, and Joseph was able to interpret each one's dream, and everything happened just as it was, as he interpreted it. And so as soon as Pharaoh finds out about Joseph, he calls for Joseph to be brought up, and I believe we're in verse 15 now in chapter 41. And so Pharaoh shares his dreams with Joseph. He said, I had a dream, and no one can interpret it, but I've heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it. And he says, no, I can't. He said, but God can. He says, so tell me your dreams. And so Pharaoh said to Joseph, in my dream I was standing, in verse 17, standing on the bank of the Nile, and when out of the river there came up 7 cows, fat and sleek, and they grazed among the reeds. And after them 7 other cows came up, scrawny and very ugly and lean. I had never seen such ugly cows in all the land of Egypt. The lean, ugly cows ate up the 7 fat cows that came up first. But even after they ate them, no one could tell that they had done so. They looked just as ugly as before. And then I woke up. And then he has another dream. He says, in my dream, I saw 7 heads of grain, full and good, growing in a single stalk. After them, seven other heads sprouted, withered and thin and scorched by the east wind. The thin heads of grain swallowed up the seven good heads. And I told this to the magicians, but no one could explain it to me. And Joseph said, This is what Pharaoh's dreams mean. He said, the dreams are one and the same. God has revealed to Pharaoh what he's about to do. Seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads of grain are 7 good years. It is one and the same dream. The seven lean, ugly cows that came up afterwards are 7 years, and the seven worthless heads of grain scorched by the east wind are 7 years. And basically, he goes on to say, the seven good cows, the seven good heads of grain represent seven good, plentiful years. There's going to be an abundance in the land. There's going to be all kind of great harvesting going on in the next 7 years. He says, but those seven ugly cows and the seven scorched heads of grain are going to represent 7 years of famine. And this famine is going to be, he goes on to say, this famine is going to be so bad that people are actually going to completely forget about the 7 good years that came before. So, in verse 33, Joseph gives some advice to Pharaoh. He says, let Pharaoh look for a discerning and wise man and put him in charge of the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh appoint commissioners over the land to take a fifth of the harvest of Egypt during the 7 years of abundance. They should collect all the food during these years that are coming up and store the grain under the authority of Pharaoh to be kept in cities for food. This food should be held in reserve for the country to be used during the 7 years of famine that will come upon Egypt, so the country may not be ruined by the plan. And Pharaoh hears this plan after having his dreams interpreted. He's so excited, and he takes Joseph's advice. He says, who is so wise and discerning among us? Is there anybody more wise and discerning than this man? So he takes Joseph and says, all right, I'm going to make you the man to be the man that you just suggested. I'm going to put you in charge of all of Egypt. He says, only in respect to the throne will I be greater than you. So Pharaoh now at this point God has brought him to the point where he is in charge of all of Egypt, except for being under Pharaoh himself. So Joseph now is in charge of all the Egypt. James 4:10 says, humble yourselves before the Lord and he will lift you up. See, Joseph, no matter what situation he was in, going through a couple of very tough situations in his life, just simply put his trust in God, and God lifted him up. So we've looked at his becoming a man, his maturing. You know, God brought him from this young, cocky 17-year-old kid to a guy that had to be humbled and just simply put his trust in God. And so God has used these situations in Joseph's life to grow him. And so God brought Joseph to this point in his life and gone through these things for the purpose that we're about to look at here in these next few chapters. See, everything happens for a reason. God has a plan, and I think sometimes in life when things don't go the way we want them to go, we have trouble accepting that. We don't like to hear that. We just tend, again, we have this victim mentality. We get focused on what's going on, and we feel like we don't deserve that. We deserve better. Well, the thing is, man, God allows things to happen for a reason. We aren't always going to understand them, but it's just the truth. God allows things to happen for a reason. This was all part of God's plan. And that's the awesome thing about Joseph's story, is he just trusted God through it. So as we move on now, we're going to look at Joseph being the man. Okay, so he's large and in charge at this point. And again, our point today, providing by a life of purpose. We're going to look at Joseph's 11. We're in chapter 42 now of Genesis. Chapter 42, we're getting into the movie-making material at this point. This is why I called it Joseph's 11. So this is where the story, to me, it gets really, really good. It says, at this point, while the famine is going on, it's not just in the land of Egypt, it's all over. And Jacob finds out that there's grain available in Egypt to buy. So he actually tells his sons, the ten of the brothers, to go up to Egypt and buy grain. Now he sends all the brothers except Benjamin. See, Benjamin, remember, is the full brother of Joseph, the only other son of Jacob and his wife Rachel. So he sends the brothers to Egypt. And so for the first time, Joseph gets to see them starting in verse 6. He was the governor of the land at this point. It says, when Joseph's brothers arrived, they bowed down to him with their faces to the ground. And as soon as Joseph saw his brothers, he recognized them. But he pretended to be a stranger and he spoke harshly to them. He said, where do you come from? They said, well, we came from the land of Canaan to buy food. And although Joseph recognized his brothers, they did not recognize him. Keep in mind, this has been about 20 years now at this point. So Joseph's probably 37, 38 years old or so at this point. And I'm sure he looks a bit different. I'm sure because of living in the Egyptian culture. We actually see at one point, I failed to mention when Joseph was brought up out of prison, said they shaved his head, cleaned him up. So he probably is clean shaven. A lot of the Egyptian men back in the day tended to be that way. And he may have had some sort of jewelry, may have had some makeup of some sort. I don't know. We're not sure exactly how Joseph looked, but I'm sure he looked different enough that his brothers didn't even recognize him, it says. And so they're bowed down before him, and they're having this conversation back and forth. Joseph is dealing very harshly with them, and he actually calls them spies. Down in the end of verse 9, it says, they say, "No, my Lord, we're your servants have just come to buy food." And Joseph said to them, "No, it's just as I told you, you're spies, and this is how you're going to be tested." So Joseph's going to test them at this point. Go back to verse 13. I'm sorry, I got ahead of myself. It says, "Your servants were 12 brothers, the son of one man who lives in the land of Canaan. The youngest is now with our father, and the one is no more." And of course, the one is no more. They're referring to Joseph himself, which they have no idea they're talking to at this point. And so Joseph says, "Well, this is how I'm going to test you to see if you're not spies." He said, "This is what I want you to do. I want you to go back. I want one of you to go back to your younger brother that you've talked about and bring him back here." See, at this point, Joseph is aware. He's the truth of his dreams coming true is becoming a reality at this point. But actually, according to the dreams, the way he had them, it hasn't been fulfilled yet. Because 10 of his brothers are here. We don't have all 11 of the sheaves that he originally dreamed about. So he knew his brother had to be here. So he remembered his dreams. And as he continues to deal harshly with him, he tests him and says, "One of you are going to go back and get your brother. I'm going to keep the rest of you here in prison." So he throws them in prison. And a few days later, it says, moving down to, what verse are we at right now? 15, I believe it was. 16. He actually has a bit of a change of heart. He says, verse 17. I'm still on the... Anyway, I forget what verse it is. But anyways, a few verses later, he says, "I'm actually going to keep one of you here, and the rest of you are going to go to get your brother." And he says, "If you're honest men, let one of you stay here in prison, while the rest of you go and take grain back for your starving households. But you must bring your youngest brother to me so that your words may be verified and that you may not die." And they proceeded to do so. And so 10 of the brothers are going to go back. And it says in verse 21, they start talking to each other. It says, "Surely we're being punished because of our brother," because of Joseph they're referring to at this point. "We saw how distressed he was when he pleaded with us for his life, but we would not listen. That's why this distress has come upon us." And Reuben replied, "Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy? But you wouldn't listen. Now we must give an accounting for his blood." They did not realize that Joseph could understand him because he was using an interpreter. See, keep in mind, these brothers... are basically in a foreign land, you know, a different culture. They speak different languages. And so this whole time back and forth when Joseph's accusing them of being spies and they're saying, "Well, we're all the son of one man," and this conversation back and forth was through an interpreter, okay? So the boys would speak, the interpreter would then say it in Egyptian to Joseph, and Joseph, not that Joseph needed it at that point, but they were talking through this interpreter. So this whole time Joseph's listening, and it says in verse 24 that he turned away and he began to weep. I think at this point, as he sees their brother's guilt coming out, and obviously he knows exactly what they're talking about, and it moved to the point that he weakened. And he can back out once he composed himself, and he said he had Simeon taken from them and bound before their eyes. So at this point, Joseph also had his men load up their bags with grain. He actually had them put the silver that they brought to purchase the grain back in their sacks. And so they're on their way home, and they stop at one point to feed one of the donkeys. It says one of the men opened up their bags and discovered their silver. So they already are starting to feel guilty, you know, as they were back in Egypt dealing with Joseph, and they're bickering amongst each other, saying, "This is because of what we've done to our brother in the past." And here they are on their way home, and the silver's discovered. And he says, basically, the man says, "What is God doing to us?" They know that God's up to something. They don't know what at this point, but they feel God working on their heart. And so they continue on home, and they get home, and they tell Jacob everything that happened in Egypt. They tell him word for word. "This is what happened. This is what the man said, and we said to him." And they recount their whole conversation. And he says, you know, we have to bring our brother Benjamin up. And Reuben even steps in at one point and says, "Listen, Father, I'll be responsible for him. If something happens to Benjamin, you can kill my two sons." And Jacob didn't want to have anything of it. He wasn't interested. He wasn't going to let his son Benjamin go up to Egypt. And so basically, chapter 42 kind of ends there. We're in verse 38 where Jacob's like, "No, it's not happening." See, apparently he didn't learn from his grandfather Abraham and his father Isaac, you know, that you need to just trust God. and let go. I mean, as awesome as some of the stories were about Jacob, he certainly had his shortcomings, and he wasn't willing to let go. It killed him when he thought Joseph was dead, and so now Benjamin is obviously his favorite son at this point, and he's not taking any chances with him. But the thing is, as we move on now to verse 43, things, you know, the food that they brought home from Egypt was just about gone, and of course the famine isn't going away anytime soon. And so Jacob says, go back to Egypt and buy some more grain. And then Judah steps in verse 3 and says to his father, reminds him that the man warned us solemnly, you're not going to see my face again unless your brother is with you. If you will send our brother along with us, we will go down and buy food for you. But if you will not send him, we will not go down, because the man said to us, you're not going to see my face again unless your brother is with you. Israel asked, why did you bring this trouble on me by telling the man that you had another brother? Why did you tell him? They replied, the man questioned us closely about ourselves and our family. Is your father still living? He said, do you have another brother? We simply answered his questions. How were we to know that he was going to ask us to bring Benjamin down here? Judah said to Israel's father, send the boy along with me and we'll go at once, so that we and our children and you, we may live and not die. I myself will guarantee his safety. You can hold me personally responsible for him. And if I do not bring him back to you and set him here before you, I will bear the blame all my life. As it is, if we had not delayed, we could have been back down there and back twice already. So here it is. Judah is stepping in again, doing the negotiating, which he often does. And so apparently he was a little more convincing than Reuben was. And Jacob basically at this point gives in and says, all right, send him along. He says, take some of these nuts and different things. Take some of the best gifts of our land and send them down as gifts to this man. Make sure you take the silver that you brought back and take double the amount to pay for the grain that you need to purchase this time. And so he has the boys take all these things and pack up, and they're on their way, and Benjamin is with them. At this point, by the way, we're at Joseph's 12. Because at this point now, all 11 brothers are coming back to Egypt to be before Joseph. It says in verse 16 that when Joseph saw Benjamin with him, he said to the steward of his house, take these men to my house, slaughter an animal, and prepare a meal. They are to eat with me at noon. Now, going back a little bit, remember, the brothers have all kind of guilt at this point already. The first time they were before Joseph and being told they had to go back and get Benjamin, when they were faced with this test, it started to raise these feelings of guilt and such. And then they discover the silver. And then it says, actually, when they were telling, I failed to mention this a moment ago, when they were home telling Jacob all of the story of their first visit, each one of them then discovered the silver in all of their sacks. So every cent that they were supposed to pay for that grain was sent back home with them. And so it says at that point that they were, you know, basically they were wondering why God was letting them to go through this. And of course, remember, they've already been accused of spies a couple times, 3 or 4 times at this point already by Joseph. Joseph's testing them. And here they have all this money. And so at this point, when they're being invited to Joseph's house, taken to Joseph's house, their immediate thoughts were, oh no, they're going to overtake us and make us slaves or something worse. Their thought is, we're in trouble. Because now they're probably afraid they're going to be accused of being thieves. Okay? So they go to Joseph's steward and spoke to him in the entrance of the house. It says in verse 19 of chapter 43, we beg your pardon, our Lord. They said, we came down here the first time to buy food, but at the place where we stopped for the night, we opened our sacks and each one of us found his silver, the exact weight in the mouth of his sack. So we brought it back with us. We've also brought additional silver with us to buy food. We don't know who put our silver in our sacks. It's all right, he said. I'm sure in all the time he spent with Joseph that Joseph had probably rubbed off on his steward a bit. He said, it's all right. Don't be afraid. Your God, the God of your fathers, has given you treasure in your sacks. I received your silver. Then at this point he brought Simeon back out to them. The steward took him into the house, gave him some things that they needed to clean up and get settled in. It says, and then down in verse 28, when Joseph came home, they presented their gifts to him. And Joseph says, how is your aged father? Tell me, is he still living? And they replied, your servant, your father is alive and well. And they bowed down, prostrating before him. So at this point, the first dream has now been fulfilled. The 11 brothers have bowed down before Joseph. So that's just one of them. That's still not both dreams at this point, though. And it says, so as we continue on in verse 29, he looked out and saw his brother Benjamin, his own mother's son, and he asked, Is this your youngest brother, the one you told me about? I'm sure, you know, keep in mind, it's been 20, 21 years. He might not, I don't know how young Benjamin was. Whenever Joseph left his brother, so he hasn't seen him for a long time. He didn't even recognize him. And so when he saw his Benjamin was there, he said, "God be gracious to you, my son." Deeply moved at this sight, Joseph hurried out of the room and wept. So again, Joseph, the second time Joseph weeps upon seeing his brothers, in this case seeing Benjamin. He composes himself, he comes back out, tells his servants to serve the food. And a couple of really cool things happen here during this meal. It says that, well, a couple things actually. One thing worth noting, it says in verse 33 or 32, they served him, that is Joseph, by himself, the brothers by themselves, and the Egyptians who ate with him by themselves. Because Egyptians could not eat with Hebrews, for that is detestable to Egyptians. So that's an interesting thing to take note of. Because, again, this is a story of God's provision, of God taking care of his young nation. See, one of the ways he took care of them and kept them pure is that he's actually leading, as you'll see, he's leading them to this area because the Egyptians don't want anything to do with him. So this actually plays part of the story here in a little bit later. But then after that it says that the men had been seated before him in the order of their ages, from the firstborn to the youngest. They looked at each other in astonishment. Like, how does he know this? How did he know? It's not like there were three of them. It's not like he just sat the three down and just got lucky and put them in order. This was 11 brothers, and he put them in order from oldest to youngest. And they're just like, and they just can't figure out how he knew this. And so at this point, I'm probably sure that God's working. It's like, what is going on? And so God's continuing to kind of pick away at their hearts. And it says then, the next verse, in verse 34. So keep in mind, up to this point, they passed the first test that Joseph put before them. They went down. They brought their brother back. They were honest. They showed some integrity by bringing all of the silver back that was given back to them. So up to this point, they passed the test that Joseph has put them up to. But here things start to get interesting, because it says in verse 34 that when they served the food, they gave Benjamin five times as much as anyone else. What do you think the purpose of that is? Why would they give Benjamin five times? First you read that and think, huh, interesting. Well, see, remember what happened 20 or so years ago. Joseph was the obvious favorite son. They didn't like him. They hated him to the point that they were willing just to give him up, to send him away for a few pieces of silver and have him out of their lives. So, see, Joseph now is setting them up for the final test. What are they going to do in this situation? As the story gets a little more interesting here in a minute. But keep in mind how similar this current situation is to the situation a little over 20 years ago. Here Joseph is, even in a foreign land, being shown obvious favoritism over the other brothers. So they feasted and drank freely with him. And then we move on now to chapter 44, Silver in a Cup. Silver cup. And we're at the final test here. Hebrews 12:6 says, "The Lord disciplines those he loves, and he punishes each one he accepts as a child." See, I mentioned how they were sat in order, the brothers were, and all these different things up to this point that God's been working on their hearts. The Lord disciplines those he loves. He punishes each one he accepts as a child. He chastens them, it says in some other versions. See, God is working on these men's heart because he loves them. See, this is a story, yes, it's a lot about Joseph, but it's much about the rest of Joseph's family as it is a story about Joseph. Because, see, these 12 brothers, like I mentioned earlier, this is his young nation that he promised so many years ago to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. These are God's chosen people that he has called out and he loves. So this story is as much about them as it is Joseph. So let's look at the next part of the story now in the beginning of chapter 44. It says, "Now Joseph gave these instructions to the steward of the house, 'Fill the men's sacks with as much food as they can carry and put each man's silver in the mouth of his sack. Then put my cup, the silver one, in the mouth of the youngest one's sack along with the silver for his grain.' And Joseph did as Joseph said. As morning dawned, the men were sent on their way with the donkeys. They had gone not far from the city when Joseph said to her steward, "Go after these men at once. And when you catch up to them, say to them, 'Why have you repaid good with evil? Isn't this the cup my master drinks from and also uses for divination? This is a wicked thing you've done.'" Now, I don't think Joseph, obviously Joseph doesn't think of himself as divine, but I think he's playing up on this mystique that I think his brothers have of him at this point, because they're trying to figure out how he asked all these personal questions in their first encounter. How do you know to ask if about our father and our if we had another brother? They were sat in order by their birth. And there were these different things at this point that Joseph has a little bit of a mystique, I think, to his brothers at this point. He's kind of, I think, playing on that a bit. And so it says, as we move on now in verse 6, it says, "When the steward caught up to the brothers, he repeated these words to them. But they said to him, 'Why does my Lord say such things? Far be it from your servants to do anything like that. We even brought back to you from the land of Canaan the silver that we found inside the mouths of our sacks. Why would we steal silver or gold from your master's house? If your servants is found to have it, he will die, and the rest of us will become my Lord's slaves.' 'Very well then,' he said, and the steward gave his own version of the story. Fortunately, he wasn't as harsh, and he said, 'Let it be as you say. Whoever is found to have it will become my slave, and the rest of you will be free from blame.' So each of them quickly lowered his sack to the ground and opened it." And I can just see this going, and the steward, it says that the steward proceeded to search again, from the oldest to the youngest. And I can just see this sense of anticipation, and then this sense of relief as each one's opened and the cup isn't there. But they're working their way down from the oldest to the youngest. And then finally they get to the last one, and they're probably thinking, "All right, one more, we're good to go." And there's the cup. And of all sacks, it's in Benjamin's sack. And it says at this point in verse 13, it says they tore their clothes, they loaded up their stuff, and they went back to Egypt. Because they tore their clothes because they knew this was like a stake in the heart. All of a sudden, where they were at 20 years ago, they're in a completely different place now, because they knew that if Joseph had to be kept as a slave or worse, it was going to kill their father. All of a sudden, they were bearing the responsibility for Benjamin. It killed them when that cup was in his sack, because they were afraid that they were going to fail in what they set out to do. They said that they would bring Benjamin back safely. Judah especially said, "I'm going to be responsible for him, Father. You don't have to worry about it." So this time, they're going to take responsibility for Benjamin. And they come back, it says, Joseph was still in the house when they returned in verse 14. "And they threw themselves to the ground before him. And Joseph said, 'What is this that you have done? Don't you know that a man like me can find things out by divination? What can we say to my Lord?' Judah replied." And I love this part. "What can we say? How can we prove our innocence? God has uncovered your servant's guilt. We are now my Lord's slaves, we ourselves and the one who was found to have the cup." See, at this point, they're just confessing. "We have messed up." Judah could very well be talking about what they did 20 years ago to Joseph. But in any case, they are just admitting that your servants are guilty. And it goes on to say in verse 17, "Far be it from me to do such a thing. Only the man who was found to have the cup will become my slave. The rest of you go back to your father in peace." Then Judah went up to him and said, "Pardon your servant, my lord. Let me speak a word to my lord." And here Judah steps in again. And he's talking for the rest of his brothers. He says, "Do not be angry with your servant. Though you're equal to Pharaoh himself, my lord asked his servants, 'Do you have a father or a brother?' And we answered, 'We have an aged father, and there is a young son who is born to him in his old age. His brother is dead, and he is the only one of his mother's sons left, and his father loves him.' Then you said to your servants, 'Bring him down to me so I can see for myself.' And we said to my lord, 'The boy cannot leave his father. If he leaves him, his father will die.' But you told your servants, 'Unless your youngest brother comes down with you, you will not see my face again.' When we went back to your servant, my father, we told him what my lord had said. Then our father said, 'Go back and buy a little more grain.' But we said, 'We cannot go down. Only if our younger brother is with us will we go. We cannot see the man's face unless our youngest brother is with us.' Your servant, my father, said to us, 'You know that my wife bore me two sons. One of them went away from me, and I said, he has surely been torn into pieces. and I have not seen him since. If you take this one from me too, and harm comes to him, you will bring my gray head down to the grave in misery. So now, if the boy is not with us when I go back to your servant, my father, and if my father, whose life is closely bound up with the boy's life, sees that the boy isn't there, he will die. Your servants will bring the gray head of our father down to the grave in sorrow. Your servant guaranteed the boy's safety to my father, and I said, if I do not bring him back to you, I will bear the blame before you, my father, all my life. Now then, please, and I can just see Judah pleading, probably down on his knees at this point, please let your servant remain here as your Lord's slave in place of the boy. Let the boy return with his brothers. How can I go back to my father if the boy is not with me? Do not let me see the misery that would come to my father. So at this point, Judah, who was so willing 20 or so years ago to just be rid of his brother, to sell him for a few pieces of silver. Interestingly, they're in the same situation. Benjamin's found to have this silver cup. It's believed that this could be similar in value. It's the similarity of the stories is really something here. And the brothers have a chance to do the exact same thing again. They have a chance to be rid of the favored son and go home with their grain once again. But all of a sudden, this time, they couldn't do it because God had been working on their hearts over all these years. The guilt that they had from so many years ago, they just couldn't handle it anymore. And Judah, please, please keep me instead. I'll take his place. And so we move on to chapter 45. And at this point, it says Joseph could no longer control himself before all of his attendants, and he cried out, "Have everyone leave my presence." So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him, and Pharaoh's household heard it. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am Joseph. Is my father still living?" But his brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. The shock of what's happening, they couldn't even speak. Then Joseph said to his brothers, Come close to me." And when they had done so, he said, I am your brother, Joseph, the one that you sold into Egypt." He says, "And now do not be distressed. Do not be angry with yourselves for what you've done, for selling me here, because..." And here's the deal. Joseph at this point is revealing, and he reveals himself and he reveals God's purpose to them. He says, "Do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me. He says, he sent me ahead of you. For 2 years now there's been famine in the land, and for the next 5 years there will be plowing and reaping. But God sent me," again, here it is, "God sent me ahead of you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to save your lives by a great deliverance. So then, it was not you who sent me here, but it was God." And he goes on to say how he made me, how God brought him to the point where he was in charge and all this stuff. And it says, our verses that I read to you earlier in chapter 50, verses 20 and 21, he says it again. This is actually shortly after Joseph and Jacob died, and the brothers were concerned at this point again that Joseph might be upset. And he reassures them in chapter 50 that though you meant to harm me, God meant it for good. But see, God had a plan for everything that happened. So at this point, it says the brothers go back. They tell their father Jacob everything that happened again. And here we are at the end of chapter 45. Verse 25, it says, "They went out of Egypt and came to their father Jacob in the land of Canaan, and they told him, 'Joseph is still alive. In fact, he is ruler of all Egypt.' Jacob was stunned. He did not believe what they said, but when they told him everything that Joseph said to them, and when he saw the carts that Joseph sent to carry him back, the spirit of his father Jacob revived." See, at this point, it says a few verses earlier, when the Pharaoh heard that Joseph's brothers were there, he was happy for him, and he said, "Send some of my chariots along and send all this stuff along to bring them back." And when Joseph saw these chariots and heard their story, he was convinced, and his spirit was revived. And he was convinced and said, "My son Joseph is still alive. I will go and see him before I die." So we move on to verse chapter 46, down to verse 28, is where we're going to pick up. Joseph's 13, so at this point, Jacob and all of his family go up with the brothers to Egypt. It says, now Jacob sent Judah ahead of him to Joseph to get directions to Goshen. When they arrived in the region of Goshen, Joseph had a chariot made ready and went to Goshen to meet his father Israel. As soon as Joseph appeared before them, he threw his arms around his father and wept for a long time. Israel said to Joseph, now I'm ready to die. I have seen for myself that you are still alive. See, much like back in 32, I mentioned the story of God wrestling with Jacob and how he was going to, this was just kind of significant of the fact that he would fight for his children, for his young nation. And this is the first of many times where God does what he has to do to protect them and care for them. As you continue to read through the Old Testament, you'll see many times where there's this back and forth between God and Israel, to where he takes care of them, provides for them, does these awesome things, and shows himself to them, and they turn around and they turn away from him. And this is one of the first, this is really the first instance here where you see God willing to fight for his young nation. And he's taking care of them. And he sent Joseph ahead to provide for them, to provide a place for them to stay and to multiply and grow. As we mentioned earlier, when they were sitting down to eat with Joseph, the brothers, that is, about how it was detestable for the Egyptians to even sit with the Hebrews. See, when they were there, it ends up, if you go on to read in Exodus, this starts after Joseph and Jacob, and all of the brothers, you know, the family dies, the new Pharaoh takes over, new ruler, and cares nothing and knows nothing about the previous story, and this starts the years of captivity for Israel. But see, it's actually during these years of captivity, because the Egyptians would not intermingle with them. They were simply slaves in the land, that Israel grew to the point, it says, if you read later on in Exodus, the day they become such a huge nation. And they stayed pure. They just, within their own family, there was no intermarrying with other families, with other nations. And this is one of the ways God provided for them. And then, of course, specifically, he provided for Jacob and his boys and his family by giving them food and giving them what they needed during this time of famine. See, God, if he loves you, if he calls you to be his own, man, he took care of his young nation. And the same, if you read in Ephesians, chapter 1, verse 11, I believe it is. In him we were also chosen, having been predestined according to the plan of him who works out everything in conformity with the purpose of his will. See, the thing is, because of what Jesus has done, we know as we read in the Old Testament that there's actually other verses that basically say that there's the verse that says there's neither Jew nor Gentile, there's neither slave nor free, and it goes on to say how basically we have been chosen to be part of God's family as well. See, anyone who has chosen to follow Christ, you are God's. He loves you. And he will do whatever he needs to work in your life, to accomplish what he's trying to accomplish. And sometimes you don't understand it. Sometimes you might understand what's going on. But God has a reason for everything that happens. Okay? You might be going through tough times. You might have dealt with tough times in your life. But trust God through it. He has a purpose for what's going on. He understands. He sees the bigger picture. You have been loved. You have been called. Trust him always. God, in this story, provided by a life of purpose. It was all part of his plan. And he has a plan for you. Let's pray. God, I thank you so much for your word and the truth that's in it, and how we can be changed by it. And God, I thank you for these last few weeks where I've been able to get into your word and let it work in my heart. And I pray that it would do the same for each one of us here. That God, we know that it says in your word that it will not return void. And I pray that your word is working now and will change each one of us to become more like our Savior Jesus Christ. Lord, as we go out of these doors, as we live the rest of this day and the days to come, I pray that we would always seek you. And Lord, when things get tough, that we always remember to keep our focus on you and trust that you are in control and you have a plan. So God, help us each day, no matter what comes, to keep our focus on you. And God, I thank you that you love us and care for us enough to do whatever it takes to accomplish your will in and through us. It's in Jesus' name that we pray. Amen.